Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On our show for you today, we'll explore the heroism and the Michigan connections of Raoul Wallenberg, a Swedish World War II hero. He helped save thousands and thousands of Jews from the Nazi Holocaust. And we'll examine how the fallout from the Great Recession will affect the future of funding for local governments right here in Michigan. Just how will cities keep up and provide the services that we've all come to expect? But first, here's a question for you. How many days did Michigan's full-time legislature work in Lansing in 2012? The answer, 81 days. And that's actually fewer days than part-time legislatures put in when you look at the 40 other states that are part-time. There are voices being raised asking just why Michigan has a full-time legislature. Indeed, some state lawmakers are pushing for the job to become part-time. Republican State Senator John Prose is sponsoring a bill to make Michigan's legislature part-time beginning in 2015.
I think that we as legislators can put our nose to the grindstone and get the work done in a timely fashion. Save a little money along the way, utilize technology that already exists for us to be able to communicate and discuss those issues properly, and then otherwise spend our full time back here in our districts listening and learning from our constituents.
Well, let's get some views on this as we turn to Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Cindy.
And from Public Sector Consultants, we welcome Senior Policy Fellow Craig Ruff. Hello, Craig.
Hey, Cindy. How you doing?
Good. Good to have you both with us. Jack, I want to start with you. Does a full-time legislature make sense to you?
Well, it depends on how it's used, and it depends on what we want out of them, and it depends on whether we care who owns them or not. Personally, I would rather have a full-time legislature with a decent pay level, but some stipulation they don't work for other people. If you have a part-time legislature, they all are going to have other jobs, and they're going to be beholden to other interests. In the current case, some of them do legislative stuff full-time, some of them do other jobs, and it's sort of chaotic.
And Craig, you have said you worry that, if we had a part-time legislature and they're not at the Capitol while they're back in their districts, that would give the governor and his staff and lobbyists, in essence, unsupervised playtime?
The states that have part-time legislatures often cede power to the executive branch because they're only there for, in some cases like Texas, every 2 years for a couple of months. And so you don't have that kind of oversight power over the executive branch or, frankly, the legislative staff.
Well, I know that State Senator John Prose of St. Joseph has introduced a bill that would let voters in Michigan decide if our legislature should become a 90-day-year part-time legislature, and that's already more days than our full-time legislature worked last year.
Well, that's true. It is, however, a fact, as Jack can testify, that legislators don't just work on the floor of the House or the Senate. They're actively involved in committee meetings, often hearings on the road. They're paying a lot of attention to constituent opinions and questions, both in Lansing and back in their home district.
Craig's exactly right. I mean, I'm a professor, for example. I don't spend all my time in the classroom the way a auto worker spends all his time in the plant. You research, you write, you grade papers at home, you meet with people. I think to quantify it by the amount of time they're spent sitting in a chair under the Capitol dome is foolish.
Jack, I want to ask you, though, let's look back. Nearly every year, someone introduces a bill calling for a part-time legislature. And so why is this issue not getting a lot of traction with voters, particularly at a point in time when it seems voters aren't very satisfied with what they're getting out of their lawmakers?
Well, there's voter fatigue. I'm like Craig Ruff. I'm an old man. I've seen a whole lot of this happen in the past. And usually what happens is that you have legislators who are term limited themselves in their last terms, or in the present era, afraid they're facing a Tea Party challenge from the right, and so they introduce something like this. It's kind of like the old game they used to play with their own pay raises. Anyone who was in trouble potentially would be allowed to vote against a pay raise, and all the lame ducks would vote for it. These things happen from time to time. But the vote, I think there's also voter fatigue. We had six things on the statewide ballot last November. It's hard to make sense of this. It's an off year. So unless the legislature does something especially egregious or you can demonstrate some great benefit, if you abolish the whole legislature, I believe, Craig can correct me if I'm wrong, the cost of the whole legislature is just something over $100 million, maybe $130 million, which is sort of a drop of water at a $50 billion state budget. So while on paper it looks like you're having a lot of savings, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it wouldn't be very much.
And let's remember that it's the men and women in the legislature who make policy. The governor recommends policy, but it's up to the Senate and the House, and majorities in both, to actually enact something into law. So their jobs are essential to the way in which government's policies are made that affect, you know, all of us. And I'm not sure about your assumption, Cynthia.
Mm-hmm.
The voters in Michigan have never had a crack at casting a ballot for or against a part-time legislature. So my guess is that if it were on a ballot, that a lot of voters, and my guess would be more than a majority, would support it simply to mete out vengeance.
Well, with Michigan being one of only four states to have the real full-time legislature, and you look around at the rest of the nation, and with so many states doing at least a degree of part-time, you have to wonder if there isn't some merit to it.
Well, I think, first of all, some of these comparisons are specious. You can't compare Michigan, a state of 10 million people with a very diverse economy and a lot of problems, to a state like Montana, which has fewer people in the whole state than some of our counties do. And, you know, most large industrial states have something approximating a professional legislature.
What's the impetus, you know, for and behind those calling for a part-time legislature? I always ask myself that. Is it because the more time men and women spend in the capital city, they're going to be exposed to more and more pressure from special interest groups? Or are the conservatives right that when they're in Lansing, they write too much legislation and they have too much time on their hands? And so they're producing stuff that is not consequential, but is rather trivial. The other argument that those supporting the part-time legislature often make is that the men and women who serve in the legislature are paid too much. And, you know, you can compare the $71,000 salary in Michigan to legislators in New Hampshire who are paid $200 over a two-year term. It seems to me that extracting a pound of flesh by ratcheting back salaries to conform with a shorter work session each year doesn't save much money, and there are some pretty significant drawbacks.
And, in fact, one would wonder, and I think, Jack, you kind of touched on this, when you look at the fact that Representative McMillan of Rochester Hills is going to also introduce a part-time legislature bill in the House, and that would include a 75% salary cut. And right at the very beginning, Jack, you had pointed out you'd rather see a well-paid, high-caliber set of lawmakers, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah, 75% seems, you kind of wonder what kind of candidates you would attract with that.
You'd have to pay a decent salary in any walk of life to incentivize people to apply for and hold the job. And otherwise, particularly the policymaking process, if the salary dips too low, all you're going to have is very well-heeled people running for it, or people whose primary occupation is outside of public policymaking. And I'm not sure either one is a very healthy development.
And Jack?
No, I totally agree with that. And I think that if you had a part-time legislature, people who are only there for a very short amount of time, you'd give the special interest and the lobbyists even more power. There's been a problem with term limits that people really didn't have institutional memory, really didn't know what was going on, and this would just sort of complete that. So I think that I think H.L. Mencken once said that for every problem there's a solution that's simple, easy, and wrong, and I think this kind of falls into that category.
Sounds like that's a good place to leave that. We want to thank you so much, Jack Lesenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst and senior policy fellow from Public Sector Consultants, Craig Ruff. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And another headline coming out of Lansing today. If you've been keeping track at home, go ahead, scratch Senate Democratic leader Gretchen Whitmer off your list of potential challengers to Governor Snyder in next year's gubernatorial election. Senator Whitmer was widely seen as a likely prospect to take on Snyder. She's been one of his most frequent and vocal critics. But in an email blast and a video posted on her webpage today, her Facebook page, Whitmer said a hard-fought campaign for governor would just take too much time and attention away from her two young daughters.
While this decision's been difficult, knowing why I'm making it actually makes it very easy. You see, my girls are 9 and 10, and I really need to be here for them. The commitment to mount a successful gubernatorial campaign is going to require the time and energy like none we've ever seen before. And while I'm dedicated to the fight, I've concluded that I cannot be the Democratic leader, a great mom, and wage that fight in 2014 due to the age of my kids.
Gretchen Whitmer says she remains committed to helping Democrats next year, including the party's nominee for governor. Let us know, who would you like to see in the running for governor come 2014? You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Click on the link that says Stateside. And find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And of course, we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Still ahead, a conversation about the power of storytelling and networking for the business-minded. We'll have that story for you in 15 minutes. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You'll recall on yesterday's show, we spoke with the emergency financial manager of Flint, Ed Kurtz. His city is undoubtedly facing dire financial problems, but Kurtz had this serious, dire warning for cities all across the state.
Frankly, within 5 years, all of our urban cores are going to be where Flint is at today, unless some significant changes are made. The way we finance cities today is broken. We can't just keep putting the burden on the backs of the taxpayers in this city. We can't keep raising property taxes, increasing income taxes. At some point, we won't have anybody left living in the city.
So it seems here are the challenges facing the people who run Michigan's cities, townships, and villages. It boils down to these. How do you provide the services our citizens expect as we all cope with the enormous fallout from the Great Recession? And how do we pay for all of this? Those are the questions that have been put to the leaders of local governments all over the state. The results are being unveiled today in the latest Michigan Public Policy Survey. It was done by the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the University of Michigan's Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy. Here from Close Up is Tom Ivacco joining us in the studio. Welcome back, Tom.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me back.
Well, in light of the Great Recession, it's no secret that local services all over Michigan have been cut to the bone, but your data suggests that local leaders are actually pretty satisfied with the package of services that the cities and townships offer. What's behind this? What are you hearing?
We were surprised by that finding. 79% of Michigan's local government leaders, mayors and township supervisors and so on, told us that even after the cuts they've been making over the last few years, that they're still satisfied with the overall package of services that they deliver. We think that this it reflects the types of cuts that have been made over time. More of the cuts that have been implemented have been kind of on the margins as opposed to, you know, slicing out complete services. In each of the last two surveys that we've done, less than 10% of jurisdictions say that they have completely eliminated a particular service. So the cuts are tend to be a little more marginal in most cases, although there certainly are places where entire services are simply gone as well.
And I have to wonder, do you think there is a disconnect between what these local leaders think is an acceptable package of services and what citizens are expecting and wanting from their local government? I mean, I guess it doesn't seem that very often you hear of taxpayers saying, yeah, I want fewer services for the same amount of tax money that I've been putting in.
Well, that's a good question. So our survey is only of the local government leaders. We don't survey directly citizens. Mm-hmm. We did ask local leaders what they think, how satisfied their citizens are, and they tend to say the same. They think that citizens in their communities are pretty satisfied with the package of services today. I think they are like the local government leaders are likely taking into account when they answer what citizens are willing to pay for. Mm-hmm. I think if we just ask citizens, are you satisfied? I think a lot of people would, you know, would see police and fire response times getting longer and longer, parks not being mowed as frequently, and they may not be as satisfied as they were a number of years ago. But then if you ask them, are you willing to pay more, it changes the balance a little bit.
Now, you asked about the future in this survey, in the Michigan Public Policy Survey, and less than half the leaders you surveyed believe they'll be able to pay for the services that are being provided now into the future, and even if the economy continues to improve?
Yeah, it's a big concern. Local leaders are quite concerned about the future and whether or not they're going to be able to continue providing the services they still provide today based on the system of funding local government in Michigan. So one of the major issues in local funding are tax caps, property tax caps that are in the Headley Amendment and Proposal A. So even as property starts to recover from the recession and property values go up, revenue for Michigan local governments is going to be capped at whatever inflation is.
Take us back, because I know there'll be people listening who were not around, you know, we're not in Michigan or we're not really plugged into current affairs when the Headley Amendment was passed. And it certainly seems like there's a lot of dissatisfaction with that amendment.
Yes, Headley was passed back in 1978, so it was a while ago now. The idea behind Headley was to, try to limit property tax increases. And what Headley does is when property growth across an entire jurisdiction exceeds the rate of inflation, it forces a rollback in the millage, and so that the amount of revenue that can be increased is capped off. So it's a protection for taxpayers, but at the same time is going to limit what local governments are able to do going forward.
It really handcuffs them, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And if costs continue to increase for things like health care and retirement and patching streets and so on, and revenue isn't able to keep up, then things like Headley and Proposal A could be pretty restrictive.
So what are we hearing, or what are you hearing as you spoke to the leaders of local governments? What do they need and want from Lansing going forward?
Well, 58% of local leaders overall think that the system of funding is broken in the state. In the largest jurisdictions, it's 77% think that. And among these leaders who think the system is broken, overwhelming percentages, more than 80% of them, think that each of the major parts of the system of funding are broken. So that includes the gas tax, the sales tax, the Headley Amendment and Proposal A, our constitutional revenue sharing, and the new economic vitality incentive program that Governor Snyder introduced. So there's a concern across a wide range of the major parts of funding local government. We also asked what was the most important thing to fix in an open-end response, and we got responses all over the map, almost 800 suggestions.
Such as?
Well, on the Headley Amendment and on Proposal A, a lot of comments focused first on we have to just get rid of these. You know, these were in a different these were created in a different time, and they're going to hurt too much going forward. If not getting rid of them. There were concerns about allowing millage roll-ups, which were allowed early in Headley and was revised when Proposal A was implemented.
Now, what is a millage roll-up?
A millage roll-up is if property growth, if property values increase but less than the rate of inflation. Mm-hmm. Originally, the Headley Amendment allowed a city millage to automatically roll back up a certain percentage if it had been rolled back previously. When Proposal A was implemented, that was removed.
So they'd like at least to get that much back.
That's right.
You know, it strikes you in terms of improving services. Number one, they're saying we can't pay for what we're doing now. Forget trying to improve, right? You found only 26% of local leaders figure they'll be able to improve services under this current model of funding, which I guess I'm hearing a fairly clear theme that it seems to be broken. Does that mean really, Tom, that unless things change, people in Michigan are just going to have to get used to being provided less services from their government? Is this the new normal?
I think that's right. I think there's, among local leaders, there's a concern that we've kind of reached a new normal today. They have managed their way through the problems of, you know, of the recent decade. And they've hit a new plateau where they can provide services today. But looking down the road, unless there's some kind of change in the funding system, they foresee a new round of retrenchment, more cuts in services, And I think it's time to ask, is that what we want? Is that what we're willing to pay for? And what kind of services do we prefer?
And it makes you wonder how attractive is that new normal, and especially the idea of another round of retrenchments. How would that help at all to enticing new residents to our state or getting former Michiganders back here to Michigan?
That's right as well. So one of the big new features in local government is an economic development strategy called placemaking, which requires investments in a community to create, you know, nice amenities in a community that young, talented people and, you know, all kinds of residents will want to live in communities that, you know, have nice parks and vibrant downtowns and so on. And so these are the types of services that local governments probably will not have the resources to implement under today's funding model.
What becomes of this report that you have, the Michigan Public Policy Survey, the close-up at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy, University of Michigan, all these great credentials and all of this good research that's gone into this? What happens with this, or what would you want to see happen with this data?
Well, we'll be presenting this report in Lansing in 2 weeks from today, and that'll be our first major outreach. The report is being sent back to all these local governments, 1,856 jurisdictions across the state, so that they understand how their peers feel and what kind of pressure peer communities are facing and how they're reacting. The report is being sent to all state policymakers, all the legislators, and key executive leaders as well. So we hope that it's going to, you know, kick off a discussion. This is a pretty long-term issue. We don't foresee quick fixes, but we hope that this will kind of kick off a new discussion on the future of Michigan local government.
Tom Evacco is with the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Their latest Michigan Public Policy Survey was just released today. Tom, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, Cindy. Great to be with you.
From the time we are all tiny toddlers, we are captured by stories. There's just something so compelling about a good story, as I was recently reminded when my 18-month-old grandson kept begging me to read Goodnight, Goodnight Construction Site more times than I could count. Our fascination with a good story continues throughout our lives, and that is exactly what's behind a unique way of encouraging and supporting entrepreneurs. It's called EntreSlam, a storytelling competition for entrepreneurs, using the power of stories to help hardworking entrepreneurs network, share their ideas, their war stories, and who knows what else from there. Joining me now are the founders of EntreSlam, Jeannie Ballou and Krista Chambers Price, and the host of the monthly Ann Arbor storytelling events, Al McWilliams. Jeannie, I want to start with you. You say the idea for EntreSlam came from your hardworking partner, Krista, who really needed to get out of the office, or she calls it the Bat Cave. Tell us, where did this idea start?
It all started with this little show called The Moth. Have you ever heard of that? Right? NPR
Absolutely.
Listeners? I love The Moth. I'd been to The Moth several times in Detroit and Ann Arbor, and I was telling Krista about The Moth, and she had one of those light bulb moments. Ding! Wow! Why couldn't we do this for entrepreneurs?
There you go.
And I said, ding! Let's do it!
Let's do it!
And literally, we, within, that was the very end of January in 2012. Mm-hmm. By March 1st, we had a kick butt website. Mm-hmm. And by the end of March, we launched our first event.
So this became a new calling for both of you. Krista, what is so unique about EntreSlam?
Well, it provides an opportunity for entrepreneurs to tell their stories in a way that's authentic and real. Because one of the things that Jeannie and I noticed when we go to business networking events, that everyone kind of puts on a facade. They think they have to tell the right things that they think the other person wants to hear. And we thought, wouldn't it be fun if we can have a night that is fun, that has, you know, food and great food, great drinks, great entertainment, but we create a safe environment for entrepreneurs to really keep it real.
And both of you were clearly entrepreneurs. Were you involved? What was your business that you were involved with? What was keeping you in the Bat Cave, Krista?
Mm-hmm. Well, my Bat Cave was called Knowledge Crush. Mm-hmm. And Knowledge Crush is an organization that supports consultants who are trying to come up with creative ideas for taking their consultancies to the next level.
So that all kind of fit.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But you guys put this connection together, and then you found a host, which is where we bring Al in. Give us an idea. What is an EntreSlam evening like, especially for folks listening who may not be familiar with the Moth?
Well, I think what really gets me to go back every month, other than enjoying people being forced to listen to me talk, is there is a bunch of different groups of people that would normally never associate with each other that all come in, and then they're put in a fairly vulnerable situation.
Such as?
You have people with very alternative-based businesses. So you have people who, I think one gentleman has a transitional assistance consulting service where he helps people with life transitions. And then you have, you know, MBAs at Ross Business School that are, you know,
more
launching
traditional.
The next the next app that does something useless. I mean, wonderful. And they're going to make $100 million. And you have those people that would normally never give each other the time of day. And they come to this event and then they have to get up and tell a story for 5 minutes and are put in an awkward, vulnerable situation.
And by sharing stories, then all of a sudden everybody's on the same stage in facing the same nervousness or desire to tell a story. So give me an idea, Jeannie Ballou, the kind of stories you're hearing. What do people get up and tell?
I would love to share with you a great story. There's a woman named Marcy. She does Incubake. And she's created a cooperative baking kitchen for local bakers who can't afford their own commercial kitchen to all come together. She's got like over 30 of these bakers. And she just loves this thing she's created. This is her family. And she's very passionate about it. And she's a woman who's closer to our age, you know, mature. And she told her story about how she left her, you know, high-paying job to follow her passion and open this, and how much it has really changed the lives of so many people that she's able to give them that leg up. And at that same night, there were two young men from U of M who had started caffeinated baked goods business, where they figured, you know, why spend the money on a cup of coffee and a muffin when you can just put the caffeine right into the muffin, right?
I ate it.
So they told their story, and the best part for me after the evening was to see those two young guys talking with Marcy. That's exactly what Al is talking about. Like, what other condition would they, you know, come together and be chatting? You know, these guys made a beeline for her, and they were, you know, chatting it up. And
so
that's
a connection
really exciting.
Was made.
Absolutely.
And they definitely believed in their product and had obviously eaten quite a bit of it before.
They were quite caffeinated.
Before the evening started.
Right. If you're just joining us, we're talking about EntreSlam. It's a storytelling competition, like the Moth, for entrepreneurs. And the founders of EntreSlam join me in the studio, Jeannie Ballou and Krista Chambers Price, and the host of the monthly storytelling events, Al McWilliams. And Al, take us a little deeper into what it's like when someone maybe comes to an EntreSlam. It's their first time. And are there parameters? I mean, you're not talking about, people aren't talking about the first date they had in high school.
I suppose if there was an entrepreneurial slant to your first date in high
but
school.
But that's the parameter.
Yeah. Well, so there are five rules.
Okay.
And I usually remember three of them at the top of the show. It has to be 5 minutes. Has to be about entrepreneur something. Can't be pitchy. That's the big one. So you don't want to get up there and sell us your wares. And that's really the key one to stay away from. And it has to be true. And it has to be on theme. So every month there will be a theme like Western Horsemen.
My biggest mistake ever.
The Western Horsemen theme failed hard.
That did.
That was
it
not a lot
dust.
Of Western Horsemen.
Thanks for trying to work it in.
And it's, you know? Yeah, it was weird because we had hundreds of Western horse ladies show up.
but not a single
Western horseman.
It was ladies' night for the gals.
So for someone listening to us on the west side of the state who can't get to Ann Arbor and get to live as much as they might want to, is there a model? Is there a way that you might encourage other groups to try to do the same thing? Or are you thinking of taking this outside of Ann Arbor?
Well, we have received several requests from the west, center, and east side of the state. to bring EntreSlam into their community. So we are working on two ideas that will be launched this quarter and then throughout the rest of the year. The first idea is we're actually bringing people into Ann Arbor. And there's a company that we're interviewing right now that is interested in providing party buses for us. Mm-hmm. So we're actually going to bring groups of people, entrepreneurs who want to get out of town and come to Ann Arbor and come play with us.
Very fun. EntreSlam, a storytelling competition for entrepreneurs. And we've been talking to the founders of EntreSlam, Jeannie Ballou and Krista Chambers Price, and the host of the monthly storytelling events, Al McWilliams. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us in the studio.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having us.
Still to come, he was a courageous World War II figure who helped save tens of thousands of Hungarian Jews from the Nazi Holocaust. On the 100th anniversary of his birth, we will examine the fascinating life of Raoul Wallenberg. That story is coming up next. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of one of the greatest heroes of World War II. He was an architect, a businessman, a Swedish diplomat, and a humanitarian. He managed to save as many as 100,000 Hungarian Jews from the Nazi Holocaust. And for his courageous actions, he was seized by the Soviets, taken to a notorious prison in Moscow, and then basically never seen nor heard from again. Chances are good you have heard the astounding story of Raoul Wallenberg, but perhaps you didn't know that this world-acclaimed Swedish humanitarian has a Michigan chapter to his remarkable life. In the early 1930s, he studied architecture at the University of Michigan and lived a student's life in Ann Arbor. To honor the 100th anniversary of Raoul Wallenberg's birth, the university has joined with the Swedish Consulate General of Detroit and designed an exhibition to tell his story and present the choices that made him a hero to so many. The exhibition is called To Me, There Is No Other Choice. And as part of the opening, the university has brought in Swedish journalist Ingrid Carlberg. Her award-winning biography of Wallenberg won the 2012 August Prize for the best Swedish nonfiction book, and it's now being translated into English for publication into the U.S. eventually. Its title, There Is a Room Waiting for You Here, The Story of Raoul Wallenberg. And Ingrid Carlberg joins us here in the studio. It's very good to have you with us, Ingrid.
And it's so nice to be here.
You know, the story of Raoul Wallenberg echoes the perhaps better-known story of Oskar Schindler in that both men were clever, they were both resourceful and brave, and they found a way to save Jews from the Holocaust and from the Nazis. Now, Steven Spielberg's movie introduced the world to Oskar Schindler. But for those not as familiar with Raoul Wallenberg's story, describe to us how he came to be in a position during the war to make such a difference and save so many lives.
Actually, it was some kind of a coincidence, you could say. Mm-hmm. Normally, people believe that Raoul Wallenberg was a career diplomat in Sweden. Mm-hmm. He was not. He was not. A businessman. He was doing business with, he was importing, in fact, groceries from Hungary in an import-export firm, Swedish-Hungarian import-export firm situated in Stockholm. His co-worker, Kalman Lauer, came from Hungary. So you could say when the Germans marched into Hungary in the spring of 1944, of course, Raoul Wallenberg at a very early stage was alarmed about what was going on. Mm-hmm. But actually the mission to go to Budapest and to lead a rescue mission, the initiative to that mission came from the American government, mm-hmm. not the Swedish government.
Because word was getting out about the atrocities happening to Jews.
And in the late stage of the war, mm-hmm. the American government founded this War Refugee Board mm-hmm. just to try to save what was left was, of European Jewry. And the Americans, they couldn't act themselves in the place in Hungary because they were part of the war.
That's right.
So they tried to make neutral states to send some extra diplomats to Budapest to administer such a rescue mission.
So Sweden was perfect.
Sweden was perfect, but the name Raoul Wallenberg. Mm-hmm. You could believe, and I think even most Swedes believe, that it was the Swedish government who chose the name Raoul Wallenberg for this mission.
Hmm.
It was not. It was the American minister of Stockholm, because the import-export firm where Raoul Wallenberg worked was situated in the same building as the American embassy. So there he had his young candidate, the American minister, and he suggested it too. So that's how he came to be suddenly.
So this was
in Budapest.
They saw this. Raoul is a sharp, bright young man. But I have to imagine that they sensed a sense of caring that he would take this on. Saving the Jews of Budapest would be a mission to him.
Yeah, he was to be a Swede in the 30s. Mm-hmm. He was very cosmopolitan in his way of living. He had been living
here
in Ann Arbor to start with, which gave him a totally another perspective on things going on than most Swedes did. Mm-hmm. He was kind of a pioneer when it came to studying in the United States. They also saw the fact, of course, that he had been traveling a lot in Hungary. So he had his own network in Budapest. He had been in Budapest at least three times during the war. So it was natural for the Americans to ask him. He would be the perfect person, and he had no family. He could leave.
Yes, so off he goes. Raoul Wallenberg goes to Budapest, and the mission is save as many Jews as you can from the Germans and from the Nazis. And the Arrow Crossers. Who are the Arrow Crossers?
7 weeks before he came to Budapest, you could see the largest mass deportations of Jews during the whole World War II. Over 400,000 Jews were deported to Auschwitz. But when he came, suddenly the Hungarian regent, Miklos Horthy, had managed to stop the deportations for a while. Mm-hmm. So they managed to halt the deportations up until the 15th of October 1944, when the Hungarian Nazis, the Arrow Crossers, were put in power in Hungary. There was a coup led by the Germans. So Hitler managed to have his own Nazi party in Hungary.
And then all bets were off.
Then it became really rough.
So what was the method that the Swedish government and Raoul Wallenberg worked out to be able to, how did they save these people?
It's a combination. When it comes to Raoul Wallenberg, it's a combination of individual courage that he had really shown during the Arrow Cross terror in the last month of 1944. Then he was, I would say, there were a lot of neutral diplomats present in Budapest, but they all hid it in the end of 1944. Raoul Wallenberg was the only one still in the streets doing his rescue actions. But as I see it, having digged into this rescue mission a lot, his greatest achievement in Budapest was the organization that he built up in order to be able to rescue people. For this, he was financed by the Americans. Mm-hmm. So he had the task to do a very big rescue mission.
Mm-hmm. Not just a few people.
He had 350 people employed, mostly Jews who volunteered, who was protected by Swedish protective papers.
And that
so
was
that
the key,
organization
wasn't it?
Is a key. It is the heart in the whole rescue mission in Budapest that autumn.
So you mentioned the Swedish protective papers.
Yeah.
Was that the key? So he had his organization in place. What would he do then in order to secure a Jewish family or a Jewish person and keep them safe? What was the key?
The key was these protective papers. He designated a special Schutzpass called Swedish Schutzpass, which was just a fake protective paper, but it looked really good, like a normal real passport with photos and stamps and everything.
And the Germans like that.
And
they,
the Germans,
that spoke
yes.
To
there
them.
Were a lot of fake papers, but the one the artistic Raoul Wallenberg designated or created was the most credible one. And this Swedish protective paper, the Schutzpass, was distributed to Hungarian Jews with Swedish connections. You could say that in the beginning of this autumn, he only distributed those protective Schutzpasses to Hungarian Jews who could really show close Swedish connections. But in the end, it didn't matter. He When the murders didn't follow any rules, he decided not to follow any rules either.
and ultimately, he's credited with saving up to 100,000 lives, which is stunning. But what is...
It depends how you define rescuing.
I
would put it a bit lower,
a little bit,
actually,
but nonetheless, when you think
nonetheless,
of...
we are talking thousands and tens of thousands.
And for that work, it boggles the mind that the ultimate result was when the Soviets rolled into Budapest, not that he was hailed as a hero. He was arrested.
Yes.
Talk to us about what happened in January of 45.
I would say that among the Swedish diplomats mm-hmm. in Budapest, everyone agreed with Raoul Wallenberg, had the same opinion or same view on the arrival of the Soviet troops, that this was the liberation. Soviet and United States were on the same side in the war. Raoul Wallenberg had an American mission.
Yeah.
This would be terrific. So what he did was that he decided to voluntarily cross the border, or the front, you could say, mm-hmm. the border, the mm-hmm. front, to meet the Soviet army and suggest a collaboration in when it came to rescuing the ghetto in Budapest, and as well as rebuilding Hungary after the war. But he didn't have any other view than that the Soviets would applaud him for the rescue action, but they didn't. They found him suspicious.
Why? Suspicious of espionage?
Yeah. Because at that part of the war, the Soviet Union and United States were still on the same side of the war, but they were suspicious.
Of each other.
Yeah, especially Stalin was very suspicious on Roosevelt and United States, or the Western allies as a whole, because he thought he was convinced that they were going behind his back and dealing with the peace negotiations with Germany all on his own. And to be American, have an American job, if you could say
yes.
so, that Raoul Wallenberg had. Part of his job was an American mission, part of it was a Swedish mission. Although it was secret, the American role in it was secret in a way, mm-hmm. but the Soviets knew it. So they were very, very suspicious. And there were other reasons too.
Yes.
He was so creative. Raoul Wallenberg, in his work, he could meet with the devil if that could save another life.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a lot of Nazi contacts in his telephone book. So I think they imagined him being a double spy.
Okay.
Double spy, you say so?
Yes, double agent.
Double agent.
Yes. Off he was taken off to the notorious prison in Moscow where the KGB had its headquarters ultimately.
Yeah, Lubyanka.
And basically never heard from again.
But we know since the beginning of the 90s when the Russians started in a short period of openness.
After the Soviet Union collapses.
Yes, exactly. After the perestroika, mm-hmm. a lot of documents were published where you could follow Raoul Wallenberg in prison the first 2.5 years. So afterwards, we know that he was alive at least until July 1947. So 2.5 years he was in the two Moscow prisons.
And then, as I was reading the preliminary translation of your book, I get the sense as the Russians and the Soviets and then the Russians were asked, what happened? You got different stories. You got, he had a heart attack. He was executed. No, he had a heart attack. So, Ingrid Carlberg, what is your very best guess as far as what did happen to this man?
I don't, the official Russian version today, 2012, is still the same as the one left that was given to the Swedish government in 57.
Which was?
That Raoul Wallenberg died a natural death in heart attack the 17th of July, 1947. I don't believe that he died a natural death.
You don't believe it?
No. But I think that he was executed in the neighborhood of that date. That's the most credible thing, but we don't know. We cannot exclude the possibility that Raoul Wallenberg was alive for several years after 1947, since there are no credible proof of his death.
The mind demands a happier ending than that.
He demanded a Raoul Wallenberg to save his life, but there were no Raoul Wallenberg for Raoul Wallenberg.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and with me today in the studio is Swedish journalist Ingrid Carlberg, her award-winning biography of Raoul Wallenberg. We're discussing that book and the new exhibition celebrating the life of Raoul Wallenberg, opening at the University of Michigan. That exhibition, to me, there's no other choice. Talk to us, if you will, about his years in Ann Arbor. And I know it was his grandfather who felt that he needed to go someplace where there weren't a lot of distractions and get a good education.
Yes.
And so instead of Europe or perhaps the East Coast of the United States, he planted his grandson right in the heart of the Midwest in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Did Raoul enjoy his time in Michigan?
To be honest, not in the beginning. Mm-hmm. He didn't find this. He was so surprised. His father, his grandfather had told him that he has to go to United States to inhale this American spirit, this self-consciousness and everything. And he was, I think he had the picture of those skyscraper, the towns with a lot of skyscrapers,
Chicago,
the
modern
United States. And he dumped here. He was dumped in Ann Arbor and looked around, and they found small houses and a town where everybody talked about Europe. They were more interested to ask him about Europe than to give him an American spirit. So in the beginning, he was rather bored, I think. Mm-hmm. But that changed quite quickly.
Yes.
So he found it hard to leave after 3.5 years.
What caught him? What was it, his studies? Was it his classmates?
His classmates. He had a lot of friends. I do also think that he was actually quite praised during his studies. He got good grades, and they found him, I think, both when it came to art class and when it came to architectural work, he was actually having really good grades. He was mathematics and physics were his worst subjects. Mm. You could say that his language talent helped him a lot. He was fluent after a very short while, and his classmates forgot that he was not American. And then I think he just started to get into this American mood, and he felt like an American, and he started to appreciate what differed the American mood from the Swedish mood.
So in a sense, it did set him up to be the perfect person
for the
Americans to
go to. I'm very convinced that the years in Ann Arbor were decisive for him. He got that optimism and that drive that he was impressed by in America, that he came home with a lot of that, actually.
Ingrid, what lessons do you believe could be applied from Raoul Wallenberg's life that could be very important to remember in 2013?
I think that confronted with the ultimate evil, it's not enough with arguing. It's not enough with beautiful words. You need action. He was extremely result-oriented. He was not a speaker. He didn't go onto podiums and things like that. He acted and never lost his optimism, where everyone else said that this is impossible. You cannot do this. You cannot, in the middle of this anarchy of the Arrow Crossers in the end of 1944, he built up a Swedish hospital in 2 or 3 days. And everybody said it's impossible to get medical equipment, but he managed. He managed with everything. He had a lot of fantasy and creativity. So I think the action-oriented answer to ultimate evil is.
I find myself thinking of the closing scenes of Steven Spielberg's movie Schindler's List, when you see the descendants of the Schindler Jews. And you realize that of that core group, the impact it's made on the world, and one can only begin to imagine of the tens of thousands of lives that he saved in 1944 and into 45. Absolutely remarkable. The University of Michigan exhibition, to me, there's no other choice. Raoul Wallenberg, 1912 to 2012. It begins today. Ingrid will be speaking this afternoon at the Michigan Union, and it will run until March 1st at the Michigan Union. We've put a link on our website at michiganradio.org so you can get all the details of this exhibition. Ingrid Carlberg, when will the translation of your book be available here in the U.S.?
I don't know yet, but we're working on it. It's quite thick, you know.
So it is.
690 pages. So.
Well, once it comes out, I'm sure it'll be a stunning read, and I'm sure many people will want to share in that. But in the meantime, we have the U of M exhibition in order to give people a better understanding of this remarkable man. Thank you so much for joining us today.
thank you for inviting me.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our show today was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Maya Friedman, Emily Fox, and Cameron Stewart. This program is a production of Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's talk again tomorrow afternoon at 3:00.